Policy and Finance Committee to order. First thing I'd like to do is have the minutes approved. You have the minutes before you from February 27th, 2018. Representative Eklund, would you move those minutes, please?
Move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the minutes are approved. We have a couple of bills before us today, but before we do that, I know that there are a few people in the room today who claim to be Concordia College Cobbers, and you really cannot be a Cobber if you're not wearing your ring. So if you are a Cobber and you're wearing your ring, would you raise that, please? And if you are a Cobber and you're not wearing your ring, would you raise that, please? Okay, good. Thank you. All right. Thanks.
What's a Cobber?
I'll explain it to you later, Rumi.
You're a farm kid.
So, okay, first bill up today is House File 2802, and I would move that House File 2802 be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. And with that, Representative Lewick, to your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, and let me interrupt, too. The budget forecast thing is coming out at 9:30 today. I'd like to try and be done by 9:30. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. House File 2802 is a piece of legislation that tries to resolve a minor issue with legislation the governor signed last year, which provided basically a freeze or a kind of a long-term warranty on effluent standards for our municipal sewage treatment plants. So what this does is provides a second level of language that would clarify that we certainly are going to comply with Clean Water, Federal Clean Water Act standards. Currently, that statute that we passed last year got snagged up in the administrative rulemaking process and is under appeal right now. This simply is very similar to a finding. It simply makes it clear that we're frankly law-abiding citizens of Minnesota and certainly going to comply with the Clean Water Act, but we're going to ensure that we give MPCA the flexibility to look at these plants that are designed to operate for 20 years minimum at a time with at least 16 years of regulatory certainty. So relatively straightforward, just adds a little bit of clarification language. With that, questions or if we have testifiers.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lewick. So last year we had a bill that was passed into law that was rulemaking, and this is putting it into statute. So why, if we're providing flexibility, why does this need to be in statute? I understand that the administrative law judge disagreed with how this was done, and that's currently under appeal, but why does this need to be in statute?
Representative Lewick.
Well, we've got a huge $4 or $5 billion deficit on wastewater treatment plants. We've got a lot of huge issues with bonding, so this is just a matter of we are the legislature. The governor does sign things into law, and so this just provides a vehicle to make sure that that happens. And again, provides the flexibility for MPCA to work with all the relevant other regulatory agencies, including EPA. And move this thing forward.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lewick, what will the technology be like in 2034? Wastewater treatment technology. What will the technology be like in 2034?
Representative Lewick.
Probably more capable than it is today.
And Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and in 16 years, how much... I'm assuming there's more science. What will the research show in 2034?
Representative Lewick.
Well, Representative Hansen, it'll probably show what it shows.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Ms. Aaron. And that's the point, is that we may find things out in the next 16 years with research and with science and results and replication and that there are things that have impacts that we don't know now. And that the federal floor, I'm not too confident on what the federal floor will be on water quality protection right now. I'm not confident in using a federal standard that could get changed under this Congress and this administration with the Trump worldview that we have in charge right now. I'm not confident that that provides a level of protection for Minnesota water. So things have changed just in a year. Just in a year, we've seen changes in terms of a water quality protection. And I understand the costs, and I understand, but a 16-year waiver on a wing and a prayer seems to be unjustified hope in terms of what we can have and what we can expect in the future.
Thank you. Next testifier, Mr. Nelson, you want to introduce yourself and for the record? Oh, I'm sorry, excuse me, Representative Walgenius, you were on the list, my bad.
If you want to testify, you won't have that aisle.
Okay, thank you. Whatever you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Just appreciate the author and the committee taking the time to bring this issue back up again this session. And we do think it's important that it be addressed in this manner to get this system in place as the legislative process voted to do last session. I just wanted to point out a couple of quick things rather than repeat everything we discussed last year, and that's that the goal of this is not to somehow prevent cities from needing to meet environmental standards. The goal of this is to make sure that there is something in place so that if a community makes a massive investment in new technology to meet new environmental standards, that if those standards change, there is some assurance that the compliance arrangement will give them adequate time to finance those changes. And the 16-year number is to get roughly 80% of the debt retired. We have cities that the debt that they incur when they put a new wastewater plant in, and it's very well documented, is equal to their annual budget that they have to retire. They have as much as 25 to 30% of their annual budget sometimes in the operation and maintenance of these systems. It's the biggest investment many communities ever make. And so this would say that if you're going to have something new that they need to do, if they have already met every expected standard, the compliance schedule should be set in a way so that it's fiscally able to be a public debt that can be retired, not just keep piling on new requirements and adding new debt onto small communities or large communities that they have no way to deal with. Even the cities that get grant money have a large component of that has to be met by local matching loans. There is no free ride on wastewater in this country. I would add that this does provide an incentive for cities to move more quickly. It's a voluntary choice. They can choose to do this if they want. It's similar to the law we passed several years ago that says if you want to meet an accelerated standard for nutrient removal, you could qualify for a 20-year certainty that would not change for you. This is more general and a shorter time period. And the last thing I would say is I'm not worried about the public health and safety issues on this to the same degree I've heard others. One, the Pollution Control Agency did and still will be required to meet state and federal requirements that they are assigned to do under their authorities, including the Federal Clean Water Act. So if something that is proposed would not meet that, they can't do it, and that will be their decision, and the Clean Water Act enforces that. And secondly, the water standards are not sliding backwards. The EPA can't do that unilaterally. The Clean Water Act has an anti-backsliding provision that prevents any water standard from ever being weakened. So unless Congress changes the Clean Water Act, the standards will remain at whatever level we put them at or higher perpetually. So With that, members, I ask that you support this legislation again. I think it adds a good comfort language with the tie to federal requirements, and the league does support it.
Thank you. And, you know, I think this is a good bill. I've heard from many cities throughout the state of Minnesota who really struggle with the costs associated. And the reality is as I said on the House floor last year, cities care about water. And, you know, the indication or the assertion that cities don't care about clean water, I use the analogy of the city of Warroad on the shore of Lake of the Woods. You're telling me that the people that really rely on Lake of the Woods, you know, as a big part of their economic vitality, don't care about clean water? I find it preposterous. But Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You're right. Cities do care about clean water. And so I want to talk about drinking water and specifically about where our drinking water comes from. So 25% of Minnesotans drink river water. Specifically, when I look at the Mississippi River, there about 1 million people drink Mississippi River water. The intakes are at St. Cloud and just above Minneapolis and St. Paul in Fridley. So the Mississippi River is our drinking water. We have to clean it up. There are 202 wastewater treatment systems that you are talking about in this bill that are north of the Minneapolis and St. Paul drinking water intakes. 202. So as we're talking about cities caring about water, yes, we care about water, because what this means for us is we will need to clean up water that is more polluted than it should be. So this is a cost-shifting bill. It's not a saving money bill. It's a cost-shifting bill. 202 wastewater treatment systems in the upper Mississippi. So with that in mind, the governor smartly put on in his bonding bill $167 million of bonding dollars for water treatment systems. That's the exact number that folks told him that we could use this year. You can't use more than that. So are you saying to us you don't want the money from my constituents are paying part of that $167 million. We would rather prevent the pollution than have you pollute and we have to pay for it. So we'll pay part of that $167 million gladly. So I'm not understanding why this shift in cost is coming about on us. And to be political about it, it's not just Democrats, folks.
Okay, I guess could you rephrase your question a little more precisely?
Is there a question there, Representative Wagenius?
Yeah, there's a question there. Why are you doing this when it's shifting the burden from some communities to other communities when the communities that are going to bear the burden would like to help you pay for better wastewater treatment system rather than our having to deal with the pollution coming from them? That's my question. Why can't we find common ground in putting forth this $167 million, and that's all that the PFAs thought we could spend. But if I'd be glad to spend more doing this, if that's your concern.
I might point out that these communities are the communities that are asking for this regulatory certainty. But go ahead to the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, obviously this is not the bonding committee, but certainly that will get a very vigorous look, and I, for one, will certainly support appropriate bonding support for PFE. you know, from that perspective, we probably are very close to a full agreement on that. I'll take a little issue with you speak about these 202 municipals, small cities north of the metro area. There's a whole other group that are south of the metro area, too, so we deal with all of Minnesota, not just, you know, your specific district's problems. There's many, many more municipalities affected besides the 202 that you're naming. We've got Minnesota River, we've got St. Croix River, we've got Rainy River, so we've got a whole different group of small towns that are affected. I just simply disagree that this is a cost shift. This is a way to ensure that we continue to go forward without breaking these small cities with some regulatory certainty. You know, we do this all over in other elements. You buy a brand new car. Typically, you're going to get a warranty of 100,000 miles or whatever, so many years, based on the operational design of that car that it's going to operate, and you have to maintain it or you avoid the warranty. That's simply what we're talking about here.
Representative Wagenius.
While you are assuming regulatory certainty, you are giving the people who drink the water regulatory uncertainty. So let's go back to the $167 million, where I think we have some common ground. That money is statewide, so it's for wastewater treatment systems north and south and on other rivers, on the Minnesota and on the St. Croix. So that is the amount of money that PFA said we could spend in a year or whatever there. Mm-hmm. That was it. Now, if you think there's more money that needs to be put on the table for that, I am game for helping you do that, because it's much cheaper to prevent pollution than to clean it up. And if we need to advocate for $200 million for wastewater treatment system, I'm with you. I will talk to other people who would be with you, because it is much cheaper to prevent than to clean up. Everybody will tell you that.
I agree.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your testimony, Mr. Johnson. You said an interesting and, I would argue, correct observation at the end of your testimony, that ultimately what happens with the Clean Water Act is Congress. Congress passed it in 1972. It amends it. It updates it periodically. Are you confident that this current Congress and administration will leave the Clean Water Act alone as is?
Mr. Johnson, I think that was the question directed to you.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have no idea. I don't work in D.C. I don't lobby at the federal level.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair, but this is actually critical to this bill. And I'm not at all confident that the current Congress and administration will leave the Clean Water Act alone. In fact, there's precedent recently, you know, within a couple of years, there was a 253-166 vote in Congress to weaken clean water rules. About a year ago, the administration issued a directive to do that. So if we're confident that the federal government will keep these standards as they are, I think we're mistaken. And you know, you look at the bill, and that's the assumption in line 1.7. So we're really going down, I think, a road that could potentially really imperil our water. And I object to this bill and will vote against it.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just a short response to that. If Congress changes the Clean Water Act standards, this bill is not the issue. The standards would be weakened, and this bill doesn't change that. If this bill was not passed and Congress weakens the environmental standards, they are weakened. That's what Congress has the authority to do. So we can't prevent that with state legislation that ties it to a federal permit in this way. I would simply add that the League does even though this is not the Capital Investment Committee, fully support the governor's recommendation for water infrastructure funding. It's desperately needed by our communities out there. But drinking water sources that come from surface water already have to be treated. Our drinking water is not untreated when it comes out of a river or a lake for use. And the discharges going into it are currently regulated and are being met at the state and federal regulations. So if anything, this would increase the amount of treatment being done by some of these upriver systems. It does not weaken them meeting any current state or federal standards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a quick follow-up. You know, we do have the power as the state legislature if the federal government does tinker with these laws and weaken them to keep them strong. And I really hope we would do that, Mr. Chair, in that event.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard a lot on this issue in the Legislative Water Commission about the challenges that these smaller communities are facing. And I know that a number of these small communities are already paying five or six times the monthly rate that I pay for my water and sewer in my community. And I know that a lot of these communities are also communities where you've got a lot of seniors on fixed income. So I appreciate where you're coming from on the dollar amount, looking for some sensitivity. What I'm wondering is if there needs to be somewhat of a combination. And there's two things I'm looking at. Is number one, we know some of these communities are shrinking in size and will continue to shrink in size. And the investment that we might be looking at today for some of these communities may not be the investment that we should be needing in 5 years or so. So I think in some areas, we need to be taking a look in conjunction with the MPCA and PFA to see what makes sense. And I don't think this bill really gets to that. We need something else along those lines. But I think the other part that would make more sense instead of going with a regulation of saying, let's give them 16 years, is saying if there's a change that the MPCA says needs to be done within the 16-year period, then the PFA needs to make 100% grant and pay for the 100% solution. I think, to me, that makes a lot more sense and something I can jump on board and wholeheartedly support instead of trying to do it this way, because then it gets to meet the needs of what communities are looking for without being an undue burden and at the same time protecting the downwater people who are drinking the water. And to me, that would make a lot more sense, and I would encourage the author and the folks who are testifying to take a look at it from that aspect to come back at it from that point of view, and I'd be happy to sign on to that type of bill lever.
Thank you. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, and I realize we debated a similar thing last year, but the public who's paying attention and listening now might not have been here last year, and I think it's important to recognize that. I was wondering if you could just clarify where the 16 years comes from, because my understanding with the ALJ's decision was that kind of the perceived arbitrariness of 16 years. Could you explain that, please?
Mr. Johnson, I think you said that was 80% of what the bonding was, but go ahead and answer that again, please.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes. The number came from an initial draft of this bill, actually tied it to 80% of the depreciation of the bond debt on the facility being built. Those are very typically a 20- or 30-year bond. We went with the 20-year number and used 80% of it. That's where 16 comes from. It's not arbitrary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. And then I just wanted to clarify something you said earlier today, because I wrote it down. You said, I'm not worried about public health and safety as much as others. So I just wanted to clarify that you said that.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I did say that, referring to that some have testified that public health and safety is at risk because of this. And I am not convinced that's the case. I think the PCA and Department of Health will continue to do their job.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I am worried about public health and safety, and that is what I'm tasked to do as the person who represents Minnesotans and our communities. I think that should, public health and safety, I mean, that's in our Constitution. That is at the very top of our list of things that we should be prioritizing. And I think, you know, we talk about regulatory certainty, but science isn't stagnant, and it certainly isn't stagnant for 16 years. And my concern is also with the cost shift, not just with communities downstream having to clean up, but the cost that we're not always very good at measuring as far as, you know, the public health of our children and child development and all those things. And if we're, I mean, 16 years is a very long time to be exposed to things that are not safe. And I'm just very concerned that public health is not higher on the list of priorities here. I'm, as someone who grew up in rural Minnesota and has family in rural Minnesota, I understand that the money is definitely a burden, but there are other solutions, I think, to lessening that burden that don't put public health at such risk. Thank you.
Representative Lagunas.
Well, thank you. Mr. Johnson's testimony that, well, Minneapolis and St. Paul and all the suburbs that use their drinking water system will clean up, essentially, so that the public will not be at risk. We are doing that now. We have the highest drinking water bills probably in the state. And you're asking us to have even higher drinking water bills because we're going down the route of cleaning up pollution rather than preventing it. When there are ways that we can help and are willing to help prevent by fully funding wastewater treatment systems, and if they need upgrading, as Representative Fisher said, let's upgrade. If money is the issue, let's do it, because it will be less expensive in the long run to upgrade wastewater treatment systems than to clean up dirty water.
Next, I'd like to have the Pollution Control Agency come down, please. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Good morning, Ms. Gauthier.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Greta Gauthier. I'm the legislative director at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify on House File 2802. When the legislature considered a bill very similar to this one last year, I believe it was House File 1003. The MPCA's position was neutral. Mr. Chairman and members, again this year, our position on this bill is neutral as well, and we want to acknowledge the reference to federal law in House File 2802 is important. After the 2017 bill passed, the agency always assumed that the legislature wanted us to implement that law or that bill in accordance with federal law. In fact, Minnesota Statute 115.03 requires the agency to always work in accordance with federal law. Commissioner Stein unfortunately could not be here today, but he wanted me to let you know that we did move forward and propose the good cause exempt rule to the administrative law judge last fall, and that the administrative law judge disapproved of this good cause exempt rulemaking, which was a pretty big surprise to everyone. We immediately appealed that law judge's disapproval to the chief administrative law judge because we believe the reasons for the disapproval were outside the bounds of what the administrative law judge is supposed to do. Mr. Chairman, you and other authors in the House and the Senate of last year's bill filed a letter in support of our appeal, and Commissioner Stein wanted me to thank you for that again. At the end of the day, though, the chief ALJ upheld the ruling of the first ALJ. As a result, we have now appealed the chief ALJ's report to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We filed our appeal on Monday, February 26th. We anticipate it will take about 6 months to get an answer. The League of Minnesota Cities and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities filed supporting briefs on our appeal. The administrative law judge's opinions, administrative law judges, plural, opinions, plural, or reports, we believe were extraordinary. And we are concerned that an administrative law judge is disapproving something that was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor by using an interpretation of federal law, not administrative law. We will continue with our appeal of the administrative law judge's decision moving forward. Thank you, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand the appeals in process, and I don't know if this bill is designed to stop that appeal or finds. Usually, when we have the process going on, we don't engage, and I understand that this is not the PCA's bill, but whether that's administrative law judge or in court, making those arguments to make the arguments is the check that is on our system on soundness. So it seems that we're short-circuiting that debate if we pass this bill. Now, I understand the need, but I also understand we usually haven't tried to get engaged when those things are occurring. So, to the author of the bill, is this, if there hadn't been administrative law judge ruling, would this bill be here?
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, certainly not. We would have regulatory certainty, and MPCA would certainly have the discretion to work through this process. Obviously, that's an easy question to answer. Had that rule been adopted, there'd be no need for this bill. We're still back to really basic stuff here. We're trying to ensure that when we make these big investments to maintain clean water and improve it, that we don't unnecessarily harness these cities with literally just unacceptable debt levels that does exactly what there was a comment about. These cities are shrinking, they're going away, they're having trouble surviving. Because we continue to press on those small cities with regulatory uncertainty. It's that simple. And there's nobody out there is interested in harming clean water. This is pretty straightforward. We unfortunately shouldn't have to be here to even deal with this, but our system is pretty complicated. So this tries again to support the governor's signature and the legislature's will on what we should be doing here in this area.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to go back, Representative Look, and just understand there were several offers I think made here from at least the side of the table about trying to approach this from a different direction, in other words, fully funding the wastewater issues. Would you be supportive of that as an alternative to what you're proposing? And I just didn't hear you respond to it, so if I missed it, sorry, but I'd like to know what your response to that is.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly, but again, without this type of regulatory certainty, you're almost throwing good money after bad. And we've had that discussion. I think it's very important that we understand this is not the bonding committee. And that's important discussions need to take place, how we deal with PFA support for our local communities. Much earlier, Representative Wagenius and I indicated we're probably almost totally agreed that there's a money problem out there, and bonding is one of the opportunities.
Mr. Chairman, well, the reason I mention that is I do think the issue of health and safety is not really the priority that needs to be, unless we do that. No, and we make it hard for you to deal with the issue that you're trying to address unless we do that. So I guess Mr. Chairman, I don't know, it's not just a bonding issue, I don't think, but I mean, we have a forecast coming forward today, and I just think we should be talking about these costs, and really, I hope the committee will act in that direction, Mr. Chairman. I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What legislators should be about is problem solving, and perhaps Representative Lewick would be open for another suggestion for problem solving. And one of the things we could do is say a city is going to do a wastewater treatment system and you get a certain amount of money from PFA. At the same time that you get that money, you have a set-aside program, just like in our landfill cleanup bill. We have a set-aside amount of money that stays with PFA for just the purpose of upgrading a treatment system within the 16 years or with whenever it has to be, if it has to be done. So we could now... we do this in lands, too. I mean, we do it all over state government. I don't know why we can't do it here. Think about, at the time, a community goes to PFA and says, we need this amount of money, and it's granted. There's an automatic set-aside for future upgrades if they are needed because of new rules, because what we've heard from testimony from PCA before is, generally speaking, that is not a lot of money. If I remember correctly, it's 7% of a wastewater treatment system is probably attributed to new rules. I think PCA will correct me if I'm wrong, but we could set aside a 7%, put it in an account just for this specific reason. And then maybe we can do problem solving and common ground.
Thank you.
Well, one set aside money and leaving it sit there, in my world, that means we stop improving wastewater treatment plants out there. No, I mean, in other words, you've got resource you can invest and help communities, and now it's sitting there. So that's one consideration. But consider this. We've got things we need to fix now. And so let's set money aside and watch it over there and not go fix those things. So that's one consideration. The other is, and I think it's lost in this discussion, is as if PFA just goes down and gives us money. Those are bonds that the cities are able to have PSA issue for them. They make those payments for 20 years. So, but again, that's a completely different discussion. We're talking about here making sure that MPCA has the flexibility here to do what they normally do, and that's reconcile federal rules with state rules.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Gauthier. I'm thinking back to a bonding tour I was on this summer, and I think we were visiting a small community who was looking at upgrades, and I believe they said that the surface water quality in the stream that the effluent was being discharged in was worse than the effluent that was being discharged.
Jeez.
And I'm just checking from the pollution control agency's perspective, is that correct in some places? I know not everybody. Or is there one? Is there even one location where the surface water quality is worse than the effluent that is being discharged into the river?
Scott, I see a phone friend there. So,
Mr. Chairman, yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I don't have that information with me, but our municipal liaison, Joel Peck, is here, and I'd like to give him an opportunity to speak.
Please identify yourself for the record. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joel Peck, J-O-E-L-P-E-C-K, and I am the municipal liaison with the Municipal Wastewater Division. What you heard is correct, and I don't know what your community you're in, but that is possible. The internal loading and some receiving waters can, years and years of discharging high phosphorus, high nitrogen, other pollution into these receiving bodies, can impair a water body. And the water quality in the receiving body can be worse than the effluent coming in. But that's because of years of internal loading.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So even with 16 years, that could get worse unless we deal with non-point pollution and water quality prevention, contamination prevention efforts.
Mr. Peck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, can you rephrase that? I'm not quite sure I'm following your...
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Peck, so we can, the state can do this and hope that the federal government doesn't change the standards, but if we continue monitoring and we continue looking, we are likely to find in these... I mean, we don't have any certainty there that the water quality will get better or worse or stay the same if we have those surface waters that are already impaired.
Mr. Peck.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, we do, in other aspects of the agency's operations, specifically the TMDL process, we do address those existing impairments. They can be resolved through non-point source and other interventions on the specific receiving water that can address the impairment.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, those addressings are done through best management practices and information education, but not regulation. I understand what you're trying to do here, Ms. Representative Lewick, but I think there's a piece here, and if the risk on the non-point or on the point may be dwarfed by the non-point risk, and that we are looking at dealing with, I know that the testimony that's occurred, we've been dealing with by providing money, hundreds of millions of dollars, hoping that that gets fixed. So money alone is not going to solve these issues. I think I understand the reaction for having this bill. But I disagree with the approach. The precedent setting here could easily be applied to other things that do not clean up our water or prevent further degradation.
Thank you. Next, I've got Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kevin Ruther. I'm the legal director at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, MCEA. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. MCEA was founded in 1974 to be the legal and scientific voice protecting and preserving Minnesota's environment and the health of its people. MCEA opposes this bill because it's unnecessary. It will likely create confusion and unrealistic expectations and could lead to unnecessary litigation. To start, I want to make clear that we are not unsympathetic to the predicament that some municipalities face with aging infrastructure and the need to invest in upgrades to protect our waters from their wastewater discharges. As many of you are aware, Representative Torkelson is the co-chair of the bipartisan, bicameral Legislative Water Commission, which has been looking hard at challenges facing wastewater treatment facilities. And MCA has participated in the stakeholder process that the commission has had. And we know that there are five consensus ideas that have come out of that commission, and we're going to continue to work with the stakeholders on those ideas. And so we're concerned, like everyone else is, about this issue, but this bill is not the way to address those concerns. The bill is intended to provide a blanket 16-year exemption from compliance with new water quality requirements for a facility that has made an investment in an upgrade. And that blanket exemption violates the Clean Water Act. In order for Minnesota to continue to administer the Clean Water Act's permitting program here in the state, the MPCA has to follow federal rules and regulations. You just heard from them that they're required to do so. Those rules and regulations prohibit this type of blanket exemption. Now, the bill says that it's to the extent allowed by federal law that the 16-year exemption applies, but the exemption has already been found to violate federal law. As you've heard, two judges, an administrative law judge and then the chief administrative law judge, both looked at this issue over the past year and concluded that the exemption conflicts with the Clean Water Act. As a consequence, as I see it, there are two possible outcomes if this bill is enacted. The first would be that the MPCA would conclude that it simply can't apply the 16-year exemption, because if the PCA has to comply with federal law and the 16-year exemption does not comply with federal law, this bill isn't going to do anything. The other would be more problematic, and that would be if the PCA concludes, well, we need to do what the legislature told us to do, what these municipalities expect, and starts writing permits with the 16-year exemption in them, and that's going to lead to a series of case-by-case legal challenges. A better solution is to allow municipalities that face financial hardship to use the existing tools of the Clean Water Act. And those tools have been in place for years. They're well understood. They're intended to address the very concerns identified here. The federal law allows for both variances and compliance schedules as necessary and as demonstrated by the facts. So in sum, we recommend a no vote on House File 2802. Federal law already provides mechanisms to give relief to municipalities facing hardships due to Clean Water Act compliance. This bill would muddy the waters. It creates uncertainty and the possibility of unnecessary future litigation.
Thank you. Okay. With that, I would renew my motion that House File 2802 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. And the bill is passed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Moving right along, House File 2789. I'd like to move that House File 2789 be re-referred to the Committee on Legacy Funding Finance. Welcome. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Nice to see you could make the drive down from truly northern Minnesota. Mr. Anderson, Chair. Okay. Would you guys get started? Identify yourselves, please, and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Bob Anderson, Mayor of International Falls and Chair of the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council.
Mr. Chair, Mark Johnson, Executive Director for the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council.
Thank you.
It's indeed a pleasure to be with you this morning and members of the committee, and greetings to my representative, Eklund, here to represent the members of the council and to bring the council's recommendation to the committee and the bill that you have sponsored in House File 2789. As you know, Chairman Fabian, Representative Hansen, and Representative Lilly, who is in the room this morning, council members spend a great deal of time reading, studying the proposals, listening to oral presentations by the organizations, and then discussing the merits of those proposed plans as they make the recommendation. I'm pleased to report to you today that the recommendation comes to the legislature with a unanimous vote by the council. I'd like to bring your attention to a few items with regard to the recommendation. First of all, we had 52 requests for funding this year. 47 of those were funded. 3 received full funding. The average for many is about 42% of what they had requested. All regions of the state will see projects. This year, the council focused to a great degree on the Prairie region, the need for restoration and enhancement for the grasslands and wetland habitat and public land. A few examples of the regions that will see projects this year: Martin County WMA, the Camp Ripley Partnership, Minnesota Moose Habitat, Metro Big Rivers, and the Mississippi Headwaters Habitat Corridor Partnership will all be receiving funding. This year's recommendation comes with a 39.6% reduction in fee acquisition. Last year, the bill included 10,800 acres of fee acquisition. This year, it is at 6,500 acres. My living in a county with 67% public land ownership, I can attest to the concerns of local government. 86% of the proposed funding activity will be in the southern two-thirds of the state. Again, with the focus on prairies, the prairie forest transition region, and the urban metro. In this bill, the council has also recommended the CREP funding in concordance with the request by the 2017 legislature of up to $15 million. $5 million for the rim buffers for wildlife and water, and $10 million for the rim wetlands. My last point that I'd like to make is that the council has increased funding for the Conservation Partners Legacy Program. That is up 20% higher than the funding last year, and it's the highest amount of dollars recommended in the past 10 years. There is great interest by many smaller groups throughout the state for these projects that are under $400,000, and this added funding will help to fund those. Thank you.
Thank you. And Chair Anderson, I got to tell you, thank you for your outstanding leadership for the council. I think you've done an outstanding job of bringing a lot of different ideas together and coming up with what I consider to be a bill that's getting at the priorities that you talked about, getting away from some of the acquisition that has been happening, but really concentrating on restoration and enhancement, getting money into the CREP program that you mentioned, and the CPL program, getting money out to these smaller local groups that can actually put some projects on the ground. With that, Mr. Johnson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, will walk you through the bill at this point. We won't do a line by line. We'll give you a more of a 5,000-foot level. I'd like to use this handout that's in your possession to do that. Just really quick on the front page, you'll see some of the highlights, such as there's just under 102,000 acres and 81 miles of shoreline that will be restored, enhanced, or protected through this project. There's about another a little over $60 million projected to be leveraged to these dollars, which will come from federal, state, or private conservation funding. As Chair Anderson mentioned, there's 24 organizations in these projects that are being recommended. 2 of those are state agencies, 8 are local government units, and then 14 are NGOs or nonprofits. They're all the robust ongoing programs that are being they're receiving recommendation. This are 86% of the overall projects. So 14% of them are new projects. If you open the pamphlet, you'll take a look. On the left side it says output by acres, and on the right it says output by funding. And then there's a center page And I'll bring your attention back to this page in just a moment. But this really gives you a chance to look at the outputs from an acre standpoint and from a funding standpoint. It's probably something you want to look at later or have your staff look at. The center page corresponds directly to these two. And on one side of this, you'll see it says distribution of acres by ecological section. And on the other side, it's distribution of funds by ecological section. So the acres side corresponds directly with the left half of the interior of this project, or of this pamphlet. And what it really does is it takes that middle chart, and then it breaks down. We had a question to us as we were looking at this earlier, a question posed to us said, in that chart, it's wonderful to see the colors of how things break down, but how many acres are you really looking at for restoration in the urban metro, or how many acres of acquisition and so on? So that's what this center page does, is it breaks down those acres below. So you can see in each one of the silos exactly how much restoration, enhancement, a fee acquisition with tilt, et cetera, is being accomplished. And with that, and then same thing with the distribution of funds page and the other side of the center. If you look at the back of the pamphlet, that's where we'll go next, and that'll give you the overview, and I'll walk through that really quickly. I must give credit to Janelle Taylor with the staff for House staff for putting together the overview or the summary of the bill. She did a really good job, and I'll be repeating some of that here. In fact, but on this back page, it's broken down by section as accordance with the bill. First is the prairie section in subdivision 2 of the bill. As you'll see, there are the total bill is $113,923,000. I'm sorry. I believe it's the largest we've had so far. This is the 10th year. This is the 10th recommendation from the council, as the chair Anderson had mentioned. In subdivision 2, the prairie subdivision, there are 14 programs. 11 of them are repeat. Or pardon me, 13 are repeat phases. Anywhere from phase two to phase 10. And one is a new area. All of these are in the prairie region of the state. And again, they all, with the exception of some that extend into the metro urban area, because some of the metro urban is considered the prairie region of the state. These all include fee acquisition with PILT, without PILT, easement, restoration, enhancement, and they range from anywhere from small of $829,000 in the appropriation recommendation to $5 million, which is the rim buffers project. So that's part of the CREP funding. It's $5 million of that $15 million that Chair Anderson had mentioned in CREP funding. Subdivision 3 is the next one on the list here, and that's the forest region. It's about $9 million worth of the appropriations. There are 6 programs in this, all are repeat phases, and they are pretty much on the eastern side of the state, northern forest, metro, and down into southeast forest. So that just geographically, that's how they distribute. They're all related to forestry issues. So it's restoration, enhancement, protection of forests, forest wetlands, forest habitat, forest wildlife habitat, etc. And they range from, they're pretty concise. They range from $1.1 million to $2.1 million in size, so pretty uniform through there, or not a great distribution in amount there. Subdivision 4 is a wetland subdivision. That's $28 million approximately of the total bill. There are 6 programs in this area, and all, again, are repeat phases, all successful, robust phases, programs, I should say. And they're primarily in the prairie region, the forest prairie transition region, and the metro urban region, also some in the southeast forest region. Again, they all focus on wetlands, which includes shallow lakes. They range a bit different. They're from $1.7 million for MLT's Minnesota Land Trust Habitat, or Wetland Habitat Protection Program, to a maximum of $10 million, which is to Bowser's Rim Wetlands Partnership. So that's the other $10 million of the CREP, totaling $15 million. And subdivision 5 is the habitats portion. That's the largest in here, with just about $41 million of the appropriation recommendations. The largest of these is, actually they range quite a range, from I think $539,000 for Anoka County's Lake George Dam and Rum River Erosion Program to $11.5 million for the CPL, the Conservation Partner Legacy Program. That's the small grants portion that Chair Anderson had mentioned. There are Subdivision 6 is also on the back of the form, and that's the administrative portion for $410,000. That's the contracts management, the technical evaluations, and then the high priority pre-transaction service account. A lot of words for a contingency fund that's we have to have, and we have to renew it periodically. There are four subdivisions that aren't listed on this summary, and those are Subdivision 7 is just the operation availability. Subdivision 8 is the payment conditions and capital expenditures, capital equipment expenditures. Subdivision 9 is the mapping requirements. There aren't dollars attached to any of those, just the requirements for people. And in Subdivision 10, which you may want to turn to, it's on the second to the last page of the bill. It starts on line 26.23, I believe. And that's carry forward. It's extending availability for two past appropriations. The first one is Minnesota Laws of 2014, and it's for the Mistinka River Fish and Wildlife Habitat Corridor rehabilitation. That actually gives them an extension of 3 years to the watershed, or to the watershed district there, to get that work done. They're having it that's the easiest way to put it. It's good work. They just need an extension to get it done because of some slowdowns in the acquisition of the land that they have to acquire to get it done. The second starts on 26.24, and it's the 2015 law for the Wild Rice River Corridor Habitat Restoration, and that actually is only a one-year extension for them because that's all they felt they needed to get the work done. That is, in a nutshell, an overview of the bill. Chair Anderson, I will gladly stand for any questions you all may have.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize you want to get out of here, but I do have some questions, and I would like to ask the questions. And perhaps if they don't have the answers or don't have time, I could at least give them a heads up of what's coming at them in Legacy.
Sure.
All right.
Proceed.
Thank you. So either Mr. Johnson or Mr. Anderson, you've got 49 projects here. Out of the 47 projects, out of the 47 projects, how many of those projects are land acquisitions? It's okay. It's about half.
We'll get
and so out of the land acquisitions, how many of those do you know will you be looking for local government approval or seeking local government approval? And are the local ones you're seeking, are they more in the metro or in the rural?
Mr. Johnson.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Green, just to quickly answer your question, I'm sure we have all this information. It's just not necessarily at our fingertips. However, from a local county government approval, any of the land that DNR purchases automatically has to have local government approval. But that's the extent of it right there. Whether the NGOs that are actually asking for local government approval or not is not required by law, but DNR is the one that has to do that. As far as notification, we have been informed by every NGO that's asking to acquire land through these appropriations that their process is to inform or notify the county boards. And the way they're doing that is they're doing it with letters, and then in those letters we received all their information. It's pretty much uniform through the bunch at this point. They're providing letters, providing where those land parcels are, what the PILP is. Generally, those letters go to the county boards at least 30 days prior to closing, as my understanding is. Some of them are maybe longer than that, depending on how long in advance they know of them. So notification is happening by the NGOs. DNR, by law, is mandated to have county board approval in most cases. I think they may have a couple of caveats where they don't have to.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Well, Mr. Chair, just I'll make the statement that if you read through the book, most of the ones in the rural area do not seek local government approval. But it does lead my next question, and like I say, we're running out of time, so I'll just ask them, and you can write them down, and we'll get the answers in Legacy. A lot of the land that you're buying or that is being purchased or is purchased by other entities, NGOs, and then after it's purchased, it's donated back to the DNR. And I'm wondering if the reason for that is they don't have to seek the approval. The other question I have is on PA4. I think it would be 2D or something like that. There's a statement in here that says that it's talking about land in for the prairie restoration, and it says the refuge encompasses all or part of 85 counties in eastern Minnesota and northwestern Iowa. I would really like to know if there's any counties in Minnesota that your plan is to encompass the whole county, because it says here it encompasses all or part of 85 counties in Minnesota and Iowa. So that's the prairie plan, and I've seen parts of the prairie plan, but if you could look that up for me, and you'll find that on page 12 of the book here.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Green, could I ask if you could clarify that question for me again, please? I don't.
Well, understand. it's in the book, in your big book here on page 12 of this book, it's talking about the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge. And the plan for restoring the prairies. And on the last line of the first paragraph under design and scope of work, it says, the refuge encompasses all or part of 85 counties in western Minnesota and northwestern Iowa. I'd like to know what that means.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay. Chair?
Yep. Representative Green.
Okay. You have another one that is for prairie chicken restoration, and that is PA8, and that is in Clay, Norman, and Manoman counties, and there too, and on some and on most of these land acquisitions, even in the ones you have under wetlands, can you tell me why you're going to be farming them? Because they all of those say that they're going to be planted with crops and mostly GMO crops. And with that, you know, there's a lot more questions, but I want to let other people ask questions, and then I will get these answers and ask the rest in legacy, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time.
With that, then, in the interest of time, too, I'd like to move the A3 amendment to get the...
Mr. Chair, I had some just general questions. This is a $113 million bill.
Sure.
If it's possible, and I understand the desire for time, but I did have, if that's okay.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, thinking back 10 years, and it's hard to believe it's been 10 years, I think the first appropriation was maybe about $69 million. Mm-hmm. Would it be possible if you could provide the committee, you know, just what the appropriations, maybe a bar chart over time of what we're doing, and if you have any projections based on that. And then specifically, Mr. Chair, with the forecast that comes out today, if there is a surplus, and I don't know if it's been tweeted out or what the solution is today yet, but if there's additional projected funds from the sales tax, what would the council do? What would the recommendation be if we have additional funds that are in the Heritage Fund?
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I can answer that second one very quickly for you. Right now the council, as accordance with law, we're looking at a 5% reserve. And in December we looked at the November forecast, which actually said it looked like there was going to be some additional funds. So the council did increase its recommendations at that point. They're still a little over 5%, not much, but a little bit. And just wanted to make sure that we left some wiggle room for the forecast here in February. If for some reason the forecast falls, then we'll have to look at sharpening up the bill. But otherwise the council, I think at this point, was quite happy with its recommendations and settled on not changing that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these are fiscal questions, and I'm not on legacy, so I want to make sure I get. So if we do have any cancellations that go back into the fund, have there been cancellations from prior fund? Is that taken into account, or do you anticipate any additional cancellations at the end of this fiscal year?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, those cancellations do go back into the fund, and they are then available for future appropriation or recommendation for appropriation. Also, if there are any cancellations, any funds that are unspent, I'll come back.
And, Mr. Chair, I have one specific cancellation. I'm wondering, did the carp barrier appropriation, I think from 13 or 14, did that get canceled or did that get completely expended? Or is it still out there for expenditure?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe that one's still active, but it's coming up close. I give you the detailed information on that if you'd like.
Okay, good. All right. So with that, again, I'd like to move the A3 amendment to the bill to get the bill in the shape that I, the author, would like.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd like a roll call on the amendment. Sure. And I'd like to speak to it if possible.
Sure. Absolutely. We've got some county people that get you down and DNR to come down and Mr. Swanson and Ms. Burquam. And with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
I, okay.
Yeah, unless you want to present it.
Yes. Okay. So in the amendment that we have before us, basically what this is this is the notification part of what has been a lengthy discussion we've had here in the legislature, and basically what we want to do is we want to carbon copy what DNR is doing now with the NGOs and go through a process of local notification. So, to the testifiers, who wants to go first? Mr. Meyer?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Bear with me, I'm dealing with a little bit of Bell's palsy, so I'll try to be as clear as I can while I'm testifying.
Thank you.
In your packet, you'll have a copy of our operational order. I believe it's number 6. So you'll have in your packet, this is the document that we draft internally. It actually has a procedure of being like law within the department. These are the procedures we follow to deal with these certain activities. So this one deals with land acquisition, and rather than go through the whole thing page by page, we'd be more than happy to come meet with you individually and answer your questions. I would assume Representative Green would be interested in all the procedures we follow that's there. But if you look at page 8, Roman numeral 13, I believe it is, that talks about notification. It says the DNR will notify the appropriate county official of all proposed land acquisitions and easements, including donations. And it goes on to talk about the discipline initiating the transaction is responsible for the notification. For each transaction, the timing as to when the notification will occur will vary, but it is normal, will normally occur after an option has been signed, but before there is an election to purchase. And the county board is required for a purchase of lease or wildlife management areas, easements, scientific and natural areas, and any lands purchased with reinvested Minnesota dollars. So we communicate with the county boards very regularly. I think what I'm hearing right now is there's a lack of communication in some areas of the state with the county boards about what we're trying to do. How do we want to preserve and protect our land? I think your amendment opens up that channel. There's probably some tweaking that can be done to it, but I think if we all work together and communicate our conservation needs, we can be a lot more effective and deal with things in a lot more friendly manner. So I'm a very huge supporter of public land. I hunt, fish, trap on all of our public lands in the state of Minnesota, and I think if we do a better job, we can have a lot more productive lands in the future.
So you're trapping on 5.5 million acres?
There's a lot of beaver out there.
Ms. Burquam, identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jennifer Burquam. I'm staff with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and we represent all 87 counties of the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this amendment today. I have with me Commissioner Jack Swanson from Roseau County. He also serves as the past president of AMC. And just generally, we concur with Mr. Meyer's comments, and we're just trying to open some channels for communication here. And I will turn it over to Commissioner Swanson to go on with the rest of our testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Thank you, and members of the committee. Again, to simply repeat what Jennifer said, and we agree absolutely with what Bob said, the Association of Minnesota Counties fully supports this amendment. We think that channel of communication, which in Roseau County has been excellent, but apparently is not in all of the state of Minnesota. We think that, that your amendment, Representative Fabian, helps us as counties and as local units of government. With that, we will stand for questions.
That's pretty good for a radio guy.
Short.
And you drove 360 miles to be here, by the way. Yes, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I understand the DNR's position and probably some of the groups in AMC, the associations, the organizations. But as representatives, we represent people, not organizations or associations. And I don't quite understand why the government needs to get engaged in the transaction of property. If a seller wants the freedom to sell their property to someone or somebody or an organization or another government entity, what step is it? And this goes to the DNR requirement that exists in law already, but why should the state or the county step into that transaction? And I know of one that occurred in the last few months where then the county negotiated and compromised and reduced that acquisition. Why does the seller, if I wanted to sell property, or if you wanted to sell property, why does the government need to get involved in that? Don't we have the freedom to sell property to whoever we want? And I understand about notification, but you could have an ordinance that requires whenever there's notification that you have the ability to stop it. So this is the proverbial slippery slope. I will be back in 2 or 3 years and require it for NGOs. But I asked the question just on, in general, why should the government be stepping in to that individual transaction? And what precedent does that set for anything else that we do?
Commissioner Swanson.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, we as counties agree absolutely. If you choose to sell your property, you should be able to sell it to whomever you choose to sell it to at whatever price you can get. However, this is government dollars buying that property. It's state dollars buying the property. That's why we think there needs to be some discussion at the local level as to whether it fits, in this case, the DNR's SLAM, or Strategic Land Asset Management Program. And so that's why we would suggest that the DNR needs to be part of the conversation as well.
And I would add, too, this adds to the transparency and make sure that the people are notified about what's going on in a particular area. If the DNR eventually is going to acquire this land through, an exchange with, not an exchange, but a transfer from one of the NGOs, in essence, it's the government using taxpayer dollars to acquire something. So I think that the transparency here is excellent. But I thought I saw a hand someplace else. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hansen.
Follow-up, but there's a difference between transparency and then an insertion into the transaction and requiring the transaction to be changed based on that notification. That's a step beyond being aware. And we have payment in lieu of taxes to cover these things if it becomes state property. So there's a difference between notifying and being aware of, which I, understand that. But then to take the next step and have local government engage in the transaction and changing it, which is the logical step, it's already happened. That I think is something that we shouldn't take lightly, regardless of outdoor heritage or why. And we're often over on this side of the aisle we're accused of not being the freedom and liberty folks. That's usually you guys over there. But think about this for a moment. You're having the government step into that transaction and require changes. And that, I think, I think I asked for a roll call on this. I plan on voting against it. I think there's more here that we haven't thought out. And I understand there's other bills, so it wouldn't just be outdoor heritage. It'll be LCCMR, it'll be bonding and that. I think this is quite consequential. And I think we should revisit the issue of the DNR purchases. Now, I understand, Representative Green, about concern, and we have provided additional dollars in payment in lieu of taxes, and we will continue to have that conversation. But what we're talking about here, both with existing law and the proposed change here, is an insertion of government into that private transaction.
Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know who to ask this of, but if an NGO purchases the land, do they pay local and county taxes?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, yes, they would pay all those taxes at closing and in the future until that land would be transferred. Unless there are ways to deal with that, and maybe Ms. Taylor could help as well. I think if there's a process, if they're a 501c3 where they can claim tax-exempt status, but I do not believe any conservation organizations are doing that at this time.
And I would point out to that point, and I think Executive Director Johnson or Chair Anderson can confirm this, but the NGOs that came before us at the council all confirmed and said that they would be meeting the local property tax obligation. But Ms. Taylor, you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer is correct. They can go ahead and file for tax-exempt status. I know recently a lot of the NGOs have opted not to and have made a commitment not to do that, but there are some that do still do that for some of their conservation lands, so they do not pay taxes on everything they hold in Minnesota. And I believe that was some testimony that was before the Lizard.
Sure. And the other thing, I think that they've heard loud and clear from counties and townships and so forth all across the state that if it's in their best interest as an NGO to build a good, solid working relationship with local county commissioners and town boards and so forth, so that in the future when they want to do something there, they have a good relationship. And part of the way that they can build a good relationship is to open up communications earlier in the process. They can make a commitment. They go around the state and have all these fundraisers and so forth, which I attend and write checks out at, and make a commitment to meeting the property tax obligation and helping out local school districts and townships and counties and so forth. Members, this is an issue that's swirled around here for a long time, and we're trying to take some steps to improve communications and to improve relationships. And if anybody is opposed to improving communication and opposed to improving relationships, I think you're probably in the wrong building. So I would hope that we can get this stuff going. I think that Ms. Birkbaum said that this is my First Amendment. I'm open to tweaking it if we need to somehow. But we need to keep this conversation moving forward, and that's why I wanted to do this amendment today. Representative Clark Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chair, your comments beg the question to me. If it's in the interest of the NGOs to develop good relationships with local governments, and they are doing that, why do we need to set that into law?
Good question. And I would say I want to, I've heard it in the past that that's what they want to do, but it doesn't seem like that's what's happening. That's what I'm hearing from the counties. So I'm just trying to give them a friendly little nudge. Okay, a Fargo South Bruin nudge. How's that sound?
Go Bruins.
Mr. Chair. Bruins. Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, I enjoy communicating with you, and I think that nobody here is against communication and collaboration. The issue that we raised is what is the consequence of that, and what is that insertion of government role into a transaction between a seller and a buyer? That's different than communication and collaboration. And we want to have these discussions. I would hope that as this moves to the other committees that they will continue those discussions. I'm assuming that we'll probably have this on other bills because they seem to pop up everywhere. It's not a question of being opposed to cooperation and communication. We need to look at this, and I would oppose the amendment.
Thank you. Any further? Okay, with that, roll call on the A3 amendment. The chair votes aye.
Heitzman?
Aye.
Hanson?
No.
Thacker?
Aye.
Becker-Finn?
No.
Bliss?
Aye.
Clark? Eklund?
Yes.
Fisher?
No.
Green?
Aye.
Hoppy?
Aye.
Hornstein?
No.
Johnson? Brian?
Yes.
Johnson Clark?
No.
Lehman?
Yes.
Lewick?
Aye.
Metza? Neuberger?
Aye.
Hostin?
Aye.
Sundin?
Aye.
Swidzinski?
Aye.
Torkelson? Uglum?
Aye.
Wagenius?
No.
There being 15 ayes and 6 nays, the amendment is adopted. Thank you. Anything else to the bill? I want to thank everybody for a good discussion as we move forward. And with that, I would renew my motion that House File 2789, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Legacy Funding Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No.
The bill is passed. It's on to legacy. Thank you. With that, members, tomorrow we're adjourned and we'll.